Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 19, Text 12. Translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Sukho pavishte svatate shubhuyaha krita pranama svachikirshitang yat vigyapayama sa vivikta cheta upasthito gre bigrihita parnihi. This is referring to Maharaj Parikshit on the bank of the Ganga. After all the rishis and others had seated themselves comfortably, the king, humbly standing before them with folded hands, told them of his decision to fast until death. Purport. Although the king had already decided to fast until death on the bank of the Ganges, he humbly expressed his decision to elicit the opinions of the great authorities present there. Any important decision, however firmly fixed, should be confirmed by some authority. That makes the matter perfect. This means that the monarchs who ruled the earth in those days were not irresponsible dictators. They scrupulously followed the authoritative decisions of the saints and sages in terms of Vedic injunction. Maharaj Parikshit, as a perfect king, followed the principles by consulting the authorities, even up to the last days of his life. Now, in the upcoming talk, I particularly want to focus in on this sentence. Any important decision, however firmly fixed, should be confirmed by some authority. Now, clearly this is not a spiritual injunction per se. It is applicable in, well, particularly within the Vedic culture in which Srila Prabhupada is referring to, the Srimad Bhagavatam he is referring to. But it makes good sense in any sphere of human conduct. So this talk that I'm going to give, it's not going to be a directly spiritual one so much as we could say it's about management, leadership, general behavior, but particularly applied to devotional life, the society of devotees. We see that Srila Prabhupada himself gave so much peripheral instruction, you could say, apart from the central instruction of understanding Krishna, surrendering to Krishna, chanting Hare Krishna, about how we conduct ourselves as aspiring devotees and as human beings. Now, I got some inspiration to speak about this topic this morning, as every morning, as I'm lying here in this hut at ISKCON Salem in South India, lying here for days on end, most of the 24 hours I'm lying down, and then just in the next opposite hut is the euphemistically called office, and there's a management meeting there every morning, headed by Gokul Chandra Prabhu, who's the temple president here. He's developed the whole project here. He came here, I'm not sure exactly how many years ago, 15 or more years ago, something like that. And he's developing a big temple, actually a huge temple, stone temple of traditional style is under construction, means he's able to elicit lots of donations, to be able to do that. If you want to send something, go to Iskon-Salem website and send it. You're most welcome. And plenty of money more is still needed to finish this building. He has about 60 brahmacharis in the campus here, locked down, including Gurukul boys who are learning from Srila Prabhupada's books and learning Sanskrit. And then just close by, a colony of householder devotees who have moved here, just close by. Of course, during this lockdown, they unfortunately can't come, otherwise they're most of the time fully involved in temple activities. The firewood kitchen, the ashram with no electricity except we have here for the shooting here. So he's doing something very special here. Clearly, he's a good leader. Not everyone can be a good leader. Some people can be good intellectuals. Some people can be good business people or farmers. And some people can be good servants and workers. We learn from Bhagavad Gita and from our practical life that not everyone is cut out to be a leader. Therefore, these seminars bring out the leader in you. To me, it just seems like a joke because there are leaders and followers, and not everyone can be a leader. Not everyone's cut out to be a leader. You can't make an ass into a racehorse. You can go to these leadership seminars and they'll tell you about leadership qualities, but to actually have them is something else. One quality of a good leader, and I'm not just talking off the top of my head here, nor talking from New Agey or pseudo-psychological books about leadership, but even in the Vedic literature, there's a lot of discussion of the roles of kings and the qualities of kings. We have the Artha Shastra, Charaka. His Niti Shastra is much better known, but he's also given that. There are so many directions on the qualities of kings. Not that you can get those qualities, again, just by reading them, but it helps to recognize who is suitable to be a king. And it helps those who are in that role to focus on what they should be doing. One of the qualities of a competent and successful leader is that he consults others, involves them in the decision-making process with the humility that I don't know everything. Here we see that it's discussed about Parikshit's humility. Already he decided to fast on the bank of the Ganga till death, but he'd already decided to do that, but he told the assembled saintly people, and he didn't expect so, but if they had not confirmed that or they'd suggested something, he was open to take their advice. So a leader, he has to make decisions, obviously. There's a difference between a leader and a bureaucrat, and unfortunately many bureaucrats don't recognize that, or they think that simply by being appointed to a position, one can become a leader. It's not simply by being appointed. So one has to make informed decisions, and any sane person should understand that I don't know everything about everything. That's only Krishna. And their life is complex. There are so many fields that they're so, if there are specialists, you take their advice. Therefore, there are ministers to the king. Not only the knowledge that other people have, but also they may have different perspectives. They may have different ideas how to go about things. They may have different perspectives on a situation which even someone who's got the savvy enough to be a leader he may not have thought about. So consulting others, when I say humility, but you could just say it's common sense also. But due to egoism, often people who get a position of power, they don't have that much common sense, or they don't exercise it. A wise king, as we find in Artha Shastra, that he keeps a knowledgeable, wise, that means that not just you amass masses of facts and figures in your mind, but you know how to apply that. You have some insights on how to apply that. Because when leaders have to make decisions, they can never be sure what's going to happen afterwards. Chess is a complex game, but it's nothing like life. Life is much more complex, because in chess there are certain rules and there's a limited sphere, but within life there are so many factors. In the game of chess, there's the kings and the queens and the pawns and the rooks and the knights and the bishops, and they all move in a certain way. But people are much more unpredictable, and circumstances are unpredictable. Things can change. So you never know what's going to happen, but it's wise to consider carefully, especially as we find from the purport that we just read, especially when making any very important decision. If you decide, well, are we going to cook carrots today or cabbages, you don't need a council meeting to discuss that. But there are obviously much more important decisions than that. So another important thing the king should look for in ministers or advisors, ultimately the king has to take the decision himself. He may do, in many cases he may just follow if he has a very trusted council of ministers or one particularly trusted minister, just like Chanakya with Chandragupta Maurya. The prime minister was advising him in all his major strategy, and the king would take his advice, but he'd have to implement it. That was not the job of the minister. A king keeps good ministers, and one of the qualities a king, if he's actually acting as a representative of the Supreme Lord, which he's supposed to do, Naranam Chanaradhipam, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, among humankind, the king represents Krishna. Krishna is the leader of all living beings. The king is the leader of his jurisdiction. So a wise king chooses ministers who care more for the welfare of the state. That means the welfare of the people, the future of the state, protecting the boundaries, keeping out or subduing thieves and rogues, and then seeing that the land is properly looked after. There's so many factors. They should care more for the benefit of the state and the people in it, and not only the people, the animals, especially the cows and all different kinds of living beings. They care more for that than for their own benefit, because if someone's in that position, they can also give seemingly benign advice, but actually they have their own self-interest. And this is the bane of politics in Kali Yuga. Prajaste bhakshiya shanti mlecha rajanya rupina. The kings and their ministers, or they act, or they pretend as if they're acting for the benefit of the people, but they're acting for the benefit of themselves. They may do. So an actually dharmic king, or someone in our Krishna consciousness movement, a leader who should actually be acting as a representative of Krishna, doing everything for Krishna's pleasure, then he wants to have people around him who are selfless. And who, in the case of the king's ministers, they should be willing to speak frankly to the king and say your policy is wrong, even at the risk of incurring the wrath of the king, because for them, doing the right thing is more important than their own position or their own physical or mental comfort. And of course, in the case of Chanakya, he just lived very, very simply, didn't take a salary. And in this way, he demonstrated that, and actually it was true, that he didn't want anything, he didn't want any material benefit from the king. He was only advising him as for the sake of dharma, for the benefit of all concerned. And even the king should think that he should trust his advisors to be so selfless and so dharmic that they would be prepared to dethrone him if they thought he was off. In other words, they're serving the king or advising the king, but it's not because of that particular personality, but of the principles that he enshrines and embodies. So a really, an actually dharmic leader should think, if I go off, if I stray from the path of dharma, then my advisors, they should advise me to get back on the path, and if I don't, then they should remove me. Who is that much selfless? Dharma comes first. Adhering to what is best for everyone concerned comes first. Mm. And understanding what is best means understanding from scripture and ultimately what is for the pleasure of Krishna. So one symptom of a good leader is that he can recognize, himself is wise enough to recognize who are wise and selfless leaders. Not like Kamsa and Jarasandha, we find that they also had advisors and ministers, but they gave them very bad advice. People tend to surround themselves with the kind of people who they like to have around them. A demoniac king will have demoniac advisors. Someone who wants to rule as a arrogant dictator, he'll surround himself by sycophants. It takes a bold leader to have around him people who can loyally disagree with him. And this morning I could hear the devotees were talking back and forward, and there was animated discussion. I'm talking about the management meeting here at ISKCON Salem. In other words, Gokul Chandra Prabhu would call, as he does every day, he calls together the devotees. It was quite a long meeting this morning. Usually it's quite brief because you just don't want to sit around talking all the time. You talk as much as you need to and then do what is required to implement what's been discussed. But it wasn't that just he was talking and dictating, and a meeting doesn't mean you call everyone and you just tell them what to do when you're dealing with you want to have intelligent people around you if you've got a big project going on. So there's a lot of back and forth. It wasn't just him talking. And it got somewhat animated. But of course, because devotees are involved. They're involved their lives, their emotions, their intelligence in all this. And so they were expressing their opinions and this and that. So this is very healthy discussion. And Krishna will be pleased by that. If devotees are giving their lives and their emotions and intelligence for serving him, one should surrender with one's intelligence. One should not surrender one's intelligence. In other words, coming to Krishna consciousness doesn't mean that you become a docile fool. That is not required. So a good leader means you have to make decisions. That's a distinction between a leader and a bureaucrat. And when you have a committee and everything is decided by a committee and then no one's responsible, and no one cares that much as someone who is the one who has to take the decision, who has to stand by them. One of the American presidents, I can't remember which one, Roosevelt maybe, he purportedly he had on his desk a sign, "The buck stops here." So he takes responsibility. So a good leader has to be decisive, but he consults also. Otherwise, if you just simply people say, well, being decisive is a leadership quality. Yeah, but not necessarily. It's not necessarily that a good leader is just decisive, but he thinks before he acts. Of course, sometimes you have to make quick decisions on the spot. But when there's strategy and planning and dealing with complex situations which don't need to be, you don't have to act on the spot. Just like, for instance, the head of a firefighting team, do they go into the house? Does he send his men into the burning house to try to save the people or not? Because, one thing is they might be able to jump out of the window. Another thing is he might let the people inside burn because he thinks it's too risky to send his men in because they'll probably get burned also. So it's the kind of thing, just you trained in advance for such contingencies, but you have to make the decision on the spot. And really, that's an example of decisions, life and death decisions. So being a leader is not always life and death decisions like that, but decisions do affect people's lives. And although there is fanfare that respect and facility that goes with being a leader, there's also tremendous responsibility that goes with it also. So decisiveness, yes, but with proper consideration. Otherwise, simply to be impulsive or headstrong, that's not the sign of a good leader. Decisions which are not taken with proper consideration are likely to harm oneself and others. So harm yourself, you may think that's not so bad, but when you're harming others, you're going to have to take responsibility. You may wash your hands of the responsibility. That wash your hands, that English idiomatic saying comes from, probably in other languages also, Pontius Pilate. He took the decision to have Jesus Christ crucified, but he washed his hands saying, it's not, I as symbolic to say, this is not my decision. Actually, it was his decision, but he deferred responsibility for it. So one has, the buck stops here. Now, within my experience, and I'm not a big leader within ISKCON or anything else, leader in the sense of making management decisions. I've remained aloof from that for quite some decades now, recognizing that it's really not my forte. Of course, Srila Prabhupada said that management follows preaching like a shadow. So I can't, if I'm preaching and bringing people in to Krishna, assisting in bringing people into Krishna consciousness, then definitely some kind of management decisions have to be made. But anyway, within my experience, I see that some people, even devotees, they don't, or they can't, or they won't consult others, or they don't like to work with others. And some decisions they make, even if all others are against it, they still go ahead with it. Or they never even hear that others are against it, because they just make the decision. They just expect, well, everyone will follow. I know better than everyone else. And there's no need to consult anyone. And so no one even bothers to try to offer advice, because they know that it won't be taken very seriously. Now, this doesn't encourage others to use their intelligence. You're not like to get very intelligent people around you, but there are some people who like that. They like to be surrounded by yes men, who just simply won't do what they say. We don't find that such people are very successful in their endeavors, although they may be by the force of their personality, but in course of time, people go against them, people resent them, people feel cheated by them. I spent years under you serving, and within the Krishna Consciousness Movement, people don't make spiritual advancement in such an oppressive atmosphere. Now, it's easy to say that, but of course, leaders also have to maintain discipline. And it's very difficult to find. There's no exact line between how much you should discipline and be strict and allow people some leeway. And again, that's one of the great qualities of an expert manager, which you can't legislate it. It's hard even to train people in such things. One has to have a feel for that, which will come from inspiration from Krishna and continuation of consciousness from previous life. Very complex matters. I'm going to give now just a small example of someone who didn't think to consult. This is a small matter. There's Gokul Chandra Tomy. It's really a minor matter, but it's laughable, actually. One of the farms, this ISKCON Salem's also overseeing several small farming projects. One of the devotees who was sent there, without asking, got a dog for the farm. Or for, I don't know, to be his pet or whatever. And then not wanted, not needed, to get a dog. Gokul Chandra asked him, "And why did you get a dog?" Rhetorically asked him, "Why did you get a dog?" And he said, "Well, no one told me not to get a dog." As if that's some kind of answer. Because there's some policy on having dogs. And generally on our farms, we don't have them. Although there could be a case for having dogs, but so far we don't have any. Okay. And then that devotee left, and I don't know what happened to the dog. But that's a minor thing, obviously. Although for the dog, maybe it's not minor if he's left without anyone to look after him. Or if the devotees who are left there don't want the dog, and they're left to try and get rid of the dog. Dogs are also living beings. Much more serious cases I've seen of devotees who are committed to leadership roles, but psychopathic in their execution of them. They by the strength of their character or their personality, not their character, more like their personality. They're very strong-minded people. They're able to get people, to bring people in, get them to do things, but at the same time, very manipulative, and they have their own agenda. I've seen in some case where someone wants to show himself as a great manager, and he's really out to outdo others, but not willing to consult, envious of others, not willing to consult with others, envious of others who maybe do better than him. Then another psychopathic disciple I had was very good at bringing people in, but some repeated complaints of misbehavior with the ladies, and but you can't talk to them. No one, even so many devotees together. Oh, another thing I'll say about both of these is they look after, so to speak, devotees, but they want followers who will just support them blindly. That's the kind of followers they want. And even as so many will say to them, you're going wrong, and their guru is saying that, even their guru will say to them, you're going wrong, but they won't accept. They can't accept that I'm doing anything wrong. Neither will they consult with anyone, nor even they're told you're going off, will they accept it, even from their guru. And then you wonder why they accept a guru at all in the first place, if they're going to be like that. And, others just don't consult, make major decisions, which in some cases really alienate everyone all around them. And just even after, everyone can see it's a very bad decision, but nothing to discuss. Who are you to discuss? And these are also devotees who have been serving for years and years and years. I know, who are you to discuss like this? So it's makes a very unpleasant atmosphere like this. These types are not the kind of types who will even listen to this talk which I'm giving now. Or even if you tell them you're like this, you're like this, you're like, they won't change. Or even they may make some show of changing. Yes, we're going to have meetings now, but then the meetings, they stop having meetings because in the meetings there's no real exchange, or there's no real respect that, yes, I really need to hear from you and hear what you have to say. Of course, you don't want to hear what, again, you have to consult intelligent people. Not that everyone, that's democracy, everyone comes up and who's not very suitable for being an advisor. That's another problem of the modern age with democracy, that so many people want to give advice and they're not really fit to give advice. There are so many people giving advice gratis, Prabhupada sometimes said with sarcastic. So many people want to advise, but they don't want to roll their sleeves up and get to work. So another thing about having advisors is the people around you who are actually committed to the project and are prepared to do the hard work to help get things going and take the difficulties, be there along with the leaders. They're leaders, they're sub-leaders who really help and are really willing to sacrifice to get things done. So they're psychopaths, egoism, it's madness of thinking I'm better than others, and won't even listen to their guru. And they're all different kinds of cases. I'm not making a general complaint against my disciples or about devotees in general, because most devotees aren't like this, and I'm very happy to be in the association of so many sincere and serious devotees. But there's some can make so many problems for others, or even just within a small sphere. For instance, one spouse wants to divorce the other, and the other spouse doesn't want to divorce, and others advise, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And the children, they don't want the parents to divorce, but want to, no, I've got to do it, this is the only way. And just don't want to listen to anyone. Again, not even their guru. And again, you wonder then, why do they accept a guru? Of course, guru is supposed to be giving spiritual advice, but in such major matters, when you know the guru doesn't want it, but still you're going to push ahead with it because you think, I'm right, I have to do it, I'm adamant. What can I say? Even Prabhupada wanted to consult. He said to his godbrother, Bhakti Rakshak, Sridhar Maharaj, he said, I have no one to consult. And you can just imagine that Prabhupada had this worldwide movement. He solicited cooperation from his godbrothers, didn't get it. We may say, well, Prabhupada, he made whatever, his decisions were perfect and everything he did, but he himself said, according to Brahmananda Prabhu, I'm experimenting. In the early days, he was experimenting with the chanting to see how it could be implemented and accepted in the Western world. Even Krishna himself, who knows everything and who can control everything, he takes advice, especially from Uddhava. We nowadays are in a much more fortunate position, being, even though we're much smaller gurus than Prabhupada, smaller in pretty much every way. But I'll give an instance. Some disciples of mine who are preaching in America, I'm in India, told me just a few days ago, I was speaking on the phone, that we in this city that we're preaching in, we're finding now quite a lot of gay men are coming and they're seriously interested, and they understand. We've preached to them and some have become more serious. We tell them that illicit sex has to be given up in Krishna consciousness and there's no scope for homosex if one is going to seriously practice Krishna consciousness, and theoretically some of them are ready to accept it. And what if some of them, or any of them, or one of them, wants to come and live in the ashram? How should we deal with this? And I told them, look, Dhanavir Maharaj is there in America. He's been in America for years. His line of expertise is recruiting devotees, full-time brahmacharis. So why don't you, better you consult him, because I don't know. I don't have experience in this line. I could give some advice, but it's good to consult him. So in that sense, we're in a more fortunate position, because there are so many devotees all over the world with so many experience in so many lines. Srila Prabhupada is largely alone in that regard. And sometimes he consulted his own disciples about various issues. What should we do? Management. He often had to take the lead himself, because Srila Prabhupada was very expert in worldly affairs, and he was training his disciples at that time who weren't expert. Another thing. I mean, there are so many things, but just one thing. I was discussing today about when I came to India first in the 1970s, then I came and stayed in India, Bangladesh. I was staying in these countries for years and years. Widows, Hindu widow, actually even Muslim widow in Bangladesh, they wear white, simple white cloths. And all North India, they wear white cloths, no sewn cloths. Here in South India, in this part of South India, the widows wear yellow, like almost muddy looking color cloth, and it's different. In Gujarat they wear blue and this, but they have a distinctive cloth and they don't wear bangles or any ornaments and no sindur, nothing. They become very plain in their appearance. So several times five times, I've said to disciples who are widowed, they're widows, that, well, now you should wear this cloth and not, you know. Actually, some have. Out of them, two out of five. The others? They don't want to. What can you do? I'm not gonna bang them on the head and tell them you have to. But it would be better if they did. There's a reason for all this culture. So what is the point of this talk if I'm saying that these people don't listen? So what's the point of this talk? Well, the point is better to recognize, well, if we do have that tendency that we're very headstrong, we do whatever we want to do and we don't want to take any, well, maybe we could become a little more wise. You can't please everyone, you can't consult everyone, but one should recognize who is worth taking guidance from. At least we can recognize and be careful, be very careful. Nowadays, having had experience of leaders who seem to do very well, but then we see that their motivations are not good, and their single-mindedness by which they don't want to take advice from others, even when they're going off. Nowadays, I'm more careful, and if I see someone like this, then I'll tend to not encourage their expansive tendencies, not to help them to become a leader. And we'll have to see if they're going to get this out of the system, because once someone takes a leadership role and they expand, but they expand their ego, then it becomes very difficult to deal with them afterwards. So you may say, well, Srila Prabhupada engaged so many people like that, I mean, obstreperous leaders who sometimes even fought with him. Yeah, he did. Some of them were like that, and Srila Prabhupada had the vision and the purity, that in his own personal purity, that they can become purified by following his order, and they got the movement, Srila Prabhupada got the movement spread very widely, very quickly, with people who could get things done. I'm not saying all of Prabhupada's closest disciples and leaders were psychopaths. There may have been some who had some tendencies like that. But at least for myself, it's can actually set the preaching back, in as much as things seem to be expanding, but they're not expanding in a actually pleasing Krishna conscious manner. Purity is the force. And also I think that, well, maybe there are other gurus and leaders in our ISKCON, big leaders, who can accommodate such people and digest their uncooperativeness and their separatist tendencies, and they can digest and they can manage it. So they may be initiated, but let them go to somewhere else and serve under them, and let them deal with it. I don't have to. I'm not forced to. Prabhupada took everyone under the shade of his lotus feet. He was very merciful. I should recognize my own capacity, that some people are very, very difficult to deal with. They don't listen to others. So why take them on? If others want to take them on and engage them in Krishna service, all well and good. That's not very encouraging, is it? Are we chant Hare Krishna and be happy? Yeah, but it's a difficult world, and it's Kali Yuga. And even in other yogas, there are difficult people. We're all difficult because we've all turned away from Krishna. There are certain things which we should look out for, pitfalls, obstacles, and go forward with hope and faith and happiness in Krishna's service. But there's so much discussion in Shastra also to help us to be to live in this world in a manner that will help us to advance in Krishna consciousness. And some of the aspects are how to deal with the difficulties of this world and difficult people, and ourselves not be difficult people unnecessarily. So there are some thoughts, and chant Hare Krishna and be happy. Hare Krishna. Dante nidhaya chunakam padaya nipatya kritva shaka kushatam etadaham bravimi he sadhava sakala eva vihaya durat chaitanya chandra charane kuruta nuragaha vancha kalpa tarubhyascha kripa sindhubhya eva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namo.